From the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is Cool Science Radio.
Science and technology that's accessible and entertaining.
If we can understand it, you can understand it.
I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm John Wells.
Our next guest is Annie Jacobson, who has written First Platoon, a story of modern war in the age of identity dominance. Jacobson writes about a platoon in Afghanistan that was unwittingly involved in a shadowy Defense Department program to capture biometrics, that is, fingerprints, iris scans, facial images, and DNA, on 80% of Afghanistan's entire population. Now, this program, born of war, is coming home to America. Annie Jacobson, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thank you for having me.
Well, Annie, can we start with sort of the history of biometrics? No doubt this word hasn't been around a very long time, but as we know, we've been fingerprinting for, I don't know how many decades. But can you take us back to, you know, we've always done intelligence and counterintelligence and gathered data. When did it start and how has it progressed?
I mean, it's a great question. What are biometrics? If you look at the Latin word biometrics, human measurements. And it's used historically, as we know it, in forensic science, and that would be by the FBI. So you're talking about fingerprints going back, you know, more than 100 years. And then along comes facial recognition software, which has developed out of mugshots, another biometric, the human face. Iris scans were introduced into the mix by the Defense Department in the 1990s. They have now become a leading biometric. And then DNA, the genetic fingerprint discovered in the 80s, now has advanced to the point where DNA capture systems have become so prevalent that the genetic fingerprint of millions of people is being cataloged into biometric databases, both belonging to the FBI and, I think more concerning, the Department of Defense.
Absolutely. You are a very accomplished, award-winning writer. I'm curious about how you got involved with this.
Well, I was interested in First Platoon. This is a unit of, or was, of very young infantry soldiers. They all joined the Army out of high school. We're talking about 18 and 19-year-olds sent into the war theater. They thought to soldier, to be sort of this previous, you know, preconception, this idea of band of brothers, a lot of them talked to me about. And yet there they were in one of the most dangerous areas in southern Afghanistan called Zari District. Highest number of IDs going off, any IEDs going off anywhere in the country. And there they are, asked to act like cops on a local beat. They did not know they were going to be out there collecting biometrics, collecting iris scans, fingerprints, and in many cases DNA on Afghan villagers with the goal of cataloging all these people for the Defense Department. They had no idea. And I found that incredibly interesting and sort of tragic, given the fact that their mission ended in absolute catastrophe when one of the soldiers in the platoon, a first lieutenant assigned at the very end of the mission, went rogue, ordered the other soldiers to kill civilians. And this resulted in a war crimes trial, which was later overturned by a presidential pardon based on bogus biometrics. And so the plot twist in reporting this story in real time were stunning to me. And they all live on this access of big data surveillance systems that very few people know about, but should.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're speaking with Annie Jacobson, who has written First Platoon, a story of modern war in the age of identity dominance. Annie, let's go back to the First Platoon and this pardon. One of the things that you say in the book is that, you know, fingerprints, iris scans, facial images, DNA, they typically don't lie, but it's humans that lie. Is that what happened here with the First Platoon and with Lieutenant Clint Lawrence?
Absolutely. And, you know, I went into this story thinking that I began writing the story long before Clint Lawrence was pardoned by President Trump in November of 2019. And as I was reporting the story and working with his defense, his lawyers, one of whom was a former lieutenant colonel and had incredible expertise in this rare area of biometrics, I actually believe the theory that they were putting forth, that the individuals killed were terrorist bomb makers and not civilians. Now, it's a separate issue of whether or not there were grounds to prosecute someone regarding the rules of engagement. But what caught my attention was this idea that the very secretive system that the platoon was tasked with doing, capturing biometrics, somehow was involved in this potentially, you know, or legitimately complex case of a first lieutenant being convicted of murder in the war zone. Well, in filing my own Freedom of Information Act request, only then did I learn that the information the defense was presenting on behalf of Clint Lawrence was entirely made up, meaning it was not based on the identities of the actual men killed. It was based on identities of real terrorists in Afghanistan. And the way that this all unfolded for me was from my Freedom of Information Act request, I learned one of the guys was still alive. And that unspooled this tragedy on top of a tragedy of a system where that is so misunderstood by the public that the commander-in-chief of the United States could actually be lied to and make a decision based on a house of cards.
Wow. Annie, you really pull the covers back on the covert activities. And as somebody said about your book, it's almost like the tip of the iceberg with the CIA. So we really don't know all the different programs going on. But I want to ask you a question about Palantir. Is the company that the Defense Department went to aggregate the data on the war theater to try to figure out who should be tagged, tracked, and killed in Afghanistan. And that same company now aggregates data for the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services to tag, track, and locate Americans who may have contracted COVID-19. Can you tell us about the COVID side of this?
Absolutely. And again, this was another real-time plot twist for this reporter trying to understand this story as I was researching and reporting it before the pandemic. Meaning, okay, so Palantir, just for people who are unfamiliar with it, it's a data aggregation company. They call themselves the connective tissue between an organization's data, in this case, the military, capturing all these biometrics, and operational activities. So what the Defense Department does with that data has nothing to do with Palantir. Palantir always makes the case, hey, we just aggregate the data for our clients. But in the war theater, what Palantir was aggregating was for a methodology that was called find, fix, finish. So finish, by the way, is a euphemism for kill or detain. Find, fix, finish. That's the Defense Department doctrine that's based on, you know, identifying people, locating them, and then detaining them or drone striking them. Okay. Well, when I was interviewing operators who work with the Palantir software in the war theater, and they collect data from overhead surveillance systems that are sometimes giant aerostats, so like a big giant balloon placed above the war theater, looking down, in this case, on the soldiers of 1st Platoon, sucking up mass amounts of full motion video to be saved and looked at later by the Defense Department when an IED goes off. That system, mm-hmm. I was told by the operators, was coming home to the United States. And that seemed like kind of a sort of secretive, you know, forewarning. But I wasn't exactly precisely sure where this was going to happen or how this was going to happen. Lo and behold, in the middle of the pandemic, or rather in the first month of the pandemic, the Health and Human Services, HHS, makes an announcement that it is using Palantir to aggregate its data. So again, Palantir is the connective tissue. Who's the client? Health and Human Services. What's the data? Data on millions of Americans, including their health data that has to do with COVID-19. What is the operational action? We don't know. That's where it gets very spooky. The operational action is allegedly to track people for, you know, purposes of health and safety around, you know, around COVID. But what does that really mean?
Good question. Annie, I'm wondering, I mean, this is starting to sound really scarily close to some of the stuff that we're hearing coming from, you know, not very credible sources such as QAnon and, you know, this conspiracy theories about, you know, kind of crazy things like when they, you know, give us the vaccine, they're going to be implanting a locator in us and so on and so forth. Help us to discern between those two things, paranoia and conspiracy theory that we ought to be absolutely disregarding, and the exhaustive research that you have done as a very credible reporter.
Perhaps the most important question of the day, what you just asked, right? And so, you know, the reporter's job is to bring information to the people. That's my job. I really prefer writing long books because the last 100 pages or so of each of my books has footnotes in it. So you can learn where all the information comes from and you can see those sources and access them yourself. I mean, when I was writing 10 books 10 years ago, a lot of the information came from the National Archives and I had to hoof it there and sit in the, you know, in the libraries and the archives and gather this information. A lot of this information is now online. And so I cite sources by title of documents, but you can find a lot of this out yourself. As for the conspiracy theorists, you know, what people do with information, this is an age-old conundrum. People are constantly taking facts and construing those facts to case build. But that is part of human nature. And what I know my job is to fearlessly go at this subject matter and try and stay out of a preconceived idea. So for this book, for example, I was interviewing special agents with the FBI, and I was also interviewing civilian and military who work for the DOD, you know, scientists who set up these actual systems. Present the information to the people and let them decide where systems are working coherently and cohesively for rule of law efforts. Another term that is actually incredibly important has been hijacked by conspiracists. And then discern where the situation is dangerous. And I believe where the situation is dangerous is when secrecy and classification outweighs transparency. And that's what I'm seeing from the Defense Department. The FBI's systems are governed by, you know, legislative oversight. DOD, not so much. I had situations where I had soldiers telling me about being in the field collecting DNA from insurgents while they were being shot at. Imagine the integrity of that DNA sample, if you will. You know, you think of an FBI crime scene and you've got crime tape and gloves and, you know, people with decades of experience. And you've got, in Afghanistan, you've got an 18 or 19-year-old soldier with very little training taking a buccal swab, which is like a Q-tip swab, of somebody's, the inside of someone's cheek, bagging it while they're being shot at under the threat of IED explosions, to then send that off to a Defense Department laboratory and to have that information contained in the database, whoa, that's a lot of room for problems.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, tying this back to something that's coming upon us in the next handful of months is already upon some of us who have received the vaccine for COVID-19. You know, what I've heard from those who have received it upon registration, and I think it's this way with any vaccine we take, the CDC needs to know if we have a reaction and needs to be able to track that. So there is a lot of data that they gather, and we're told that they, you know, in part, it's just a big aggregation of data that we aren't going to be personalized or any of that, not unless, of course, you know, we have a reaction to a vaccine and we go in. And I realize this is a little bit of a tangent, but it comes back to the same thing, which is how do we trust? How do we know to trust? We need this entire country, this entire world to get vaccinated, right? So how, for those people who aren't trusting of the process, how do we encourage them towards that?
Well, my premise, the foundation of all of my reporting, rests upon what I call the Eisenhower principle, on President Eisenhower. You know, he warned against the military industrial complex, which is kind of like what people fear. And it's a metaphor, like I'm fearing Big Brother, right? But what Eisenhower also said in that speech, his farewell speech, in addition to being, you know, that people should be concerned about this, he also said that a knowledgeable and informed citizenry is the way to balance this all out in a democracy. So I'm all about information. And so, yes, the CDC does need information. Yes, you know, the government does need to be able to track certain situations as they unfold. But the problem is that technology is moving far faster than the courts that are able to, you know, make decisions on things like Fourth Amendment, you know, right to privacy. And the courts are moving at a snail's pace. Technology is moving at the speed of lightning. How does a democracy balance that out? I believe it starts with information.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're speaking with Annie Jacobson, who has written First Platoon, A Story of Modern War in the Age of Identity Dominance. Annie, I'm curious, what happens to our DNA after a PCR test?
Well, you got to tell me what PCR test is.
Well, it's a test for COVID.
The COVID, okay. What happens to your DNA in a COVID test in 2021 is largely unreported. Even in 2020 is largely unreported. And that has to do with what I just spoke of, that the right to privacy is moving at a snail's pace, and the need for safety and security fused with information technology is moving at lightning speed. And so whether or not that information is going into a government database that can be accessed for other purposes remains unknown. Some people say, that's ridiculous, we would never do that. But as I write in First Platoon at the end of the book, the federal government also claimed that was the position about DNA samples it was taking from migrants at the border. And as the Washington Post originally reported just last year, as it turns out, the ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, decided that it needed access to that DNA data so as to track potential so-called criminals who were potentially housing these migrants. So this idea that it can't happen is false. This idea that information sharing across federal agencies could never happen, that there's some kind of a privacy wall, is simply not true. The question of how much of it is happening has yet to be reported. And I see a dearth of reporting in that area, with so many people having focused on reporting on political matters because, of course, they have been so important in the age in which we now live.
Yes. Well, as you research this, and it's an extremely well-researched book, what most surprised you?
What surprised me was the lack of knowledge at every level. I mean, I like telling narrative stories because I think that it's so much easier to comprehend information when you're being told a story, a factual story. And for example, the fact that the young soldiers of 1st Platoon had no idea that they were capturing biometrics when that's what they were doing, that I found astonishing. And you might ask, well, how is that possible? A platoon is made up of approximately 30 soldiers. I interviewed 24 of the soldiers in 1st Platoon. Only one of them carried the actual biometric capture equipment. And that person is called a COIST, the Company Intelligence Support Team member, okay? And that person was in charge of taking the fingerprints, iris scans, and sometimes DNA of said individual, be it a terrorist, a terror suspect, or an Afghan civilian. The rest of the platoon was sitting there, you know, on one knee, keeping guard to sort of make sure they were not mortared or hit by an IED or by small arms fire. And so when I explained to them, oh, you guys were capturing biometrics, a lot of the response was, oh, now that makes sense. I find that a metaphor for this whole story.
Absolutely. You know, I wanted to ask you a little bit about facial recognition software and where we are with that. As we know, last week, following the insurrection at the Capitol, there were a few misreportings or maybe just bad data on the facial recognition software of some of the rioters. And where are we just with that kind of technology overall?
I mean, it is such a critical juncture with this. Facial recognition, you know, it began as a biometric long ago with mugshots. You know, we're talking in the 1800s, and moved to become facial recognition starting in the 1950s with the Department of Defense. And then in the 90s, the program really picked up. What has happened in this century is phenomenal and has taken off. And when you look at what you're referring to, sort of identifying insurrectionists based on photographs that are out there in the, you know, open source intelligence, it's called OSINT. This is not classified information. This is not law enforcement proprietary information. This is individual researchers who are experts in, you know, looking at photographs and identifying people, crowdsourcing information from Facebook users, from Twitter users, to try and identify who a criminal might be. While I'm all for catching bad guys, we're bumping up against a very dangerous situation where, you know, citizens are working faster than law enforcement. You can imagine the FBI, how long it takes them to get a search warrant and go knock on someone's door. By that time, the person has been outed on social media. Is that a good thing? Is that a bad thing? Boy, is it happening right in front of us.
Absolutely. Boy, that could launch us into a whole other conversation. We've got to wrap. Annie Jacobson is our guest. She is a Pulitzer Prize finalist and the author of the bestseller, Area 51. She's back with 1st Platoon, which we've been speaking about today. It's a story of modern war in the age of identity dominance. Annie, thank you so much for your time today.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for tuning in to Cool Science Radio.
If you enjoyed this episode, please rate us, give us a 5, and leave us a comment.
Take us along on your next adventure to the moon.
If you have any story ideas, please let us know at coolscienceradio@kpcw.org.
Thanks for listening, and hey, tune in next week.